and welcome to Big Cabbage Radio, and this is Radio Book Club. This is where we read a book together in the community, and I'm on the air discussing it with some of my guests. I'm Judy Getty, and I want to remind you that if you are a member of a book club in the Palmer area and would like to suggest a book to discuss on the air, please contact me at the station or through the email, and we can look at possibly bringing you on the air. I'd also like to remind you that if you want to call in today and comment on the conversation, the number is 745-8900. And today we're discussing the book, The Golem and the Ginny by Helene Wecker. And joining me are two members of the Fireside Book Club, Melissa Benke and Marianne Cockle. Hello and welcome.
Hi there.
Hello.
So, Melissa, do you want to tell us a little bit about your book club?
Sure. I think our book club started sometime during the first year we opened Fireside Books. Two wonderful women walked in and asked if we had a book club. They were already members of another one, but they were interested in starting another book club. They liked the idea of meeting someplace besides their own homes. I think it was probably partly so they wouldn't have to clean their house every time. They also clearly wanted to support their local independent bookstore. So we've been meeting ever since. We have two basic rules. One is that we read paperback books to keep the expense down. And we did have one exception to that when we decided to read The Snow Child by Eowyn Ivey. We read it when it was a hardback. And the second is that there is an expectation that members will purchase at least some of their books from Fireside Books.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So we read a wide variety of books. We read fiction as well as nonfiction. We read some bestsellers, mysteries, classic literature, just whatever the members suggest and ask for.
And is it an open book club? Can other people just walk in and join, or is it a closed group?
It's closed because of limited space and just, you know, people over the years, some people have moved away and we've had new members join, but at this point it is closed, unfortunately.
Okay. And Marianne, you're a member there, so what do you have to say about your book club?
Oh, I think it's a hoot. It's it's very informal, and so I know a lot of people have an impression of book clubs as being academic or literary nerdy, but it doesn't have to be. And it's a social gathering sometimes, and then sometimes it does get intellectual. It just depends on the topic. Nothing to be intimidated about if you are thinking about maybe joining a book club.
Right.
And it can become a bit addictive. So with doing the radio show, I belong to two other book clubs, so now I'm on three. And I think, Marianne, you're up there also.
I got three.
Okay. A little competition going here. Melissa, is it just one?
It is just one.
Okay. Well, so today we're going to talk about The Golem and the Ginny, and I thought maybe we could start out talking about what are those two characters. So Marianne was going to look into that and define that.
The golem. Let's start with the golem. It comes from Jewish folklore, and it is defined as an animated anthropomorphic being created entirely from inanimate matter. And it is believed that people with certain powers can bring these inanimate objects to life. And they are typically meant to be subservient, under your command. One version of the folklore is that they cannot speak, but I suppose that depends on the wizard's powers of what they want to have the golem do for them. They are essentially a slave made out of inanimate object, and they are supposed to be made out of clay or mud. So that's the basic. And there's all sorts of interesting history. But it looks like it is mentioned in old text, but there is a belief that there is someone who actually did bring a golem to life. But that's actually pretty recent, only within the past couple hundred years. So, yes.
And we thought this was fantasy.
Yeah. No. Apparently, some people do believe that it has happened. And then a ginny or a jinn is mentioned in the Quran, and it is a being made of smokeless and scorching fire, but also they are physical in nature, and they are able to interact physically with people and objects and likewise be acted upon. They can be good or evil or neutrally benevolent. They can have free will like humans. And there's an etymology, which I thought was pretty interesting, because I got it confused with genie, G-E-N-I-E, and then this is Ginny, J-I-N-N-I, is from the book. Apparently, the French, there is a French word that genie comes from, and it is a guardian spirit. But the confusion comes from the book of 1001 Nights, where genie, the French version, was used as a translation of Ginny, J-I-N-N-I. Hmm. So if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the original 1001 Arabian Nights, where a genie was present, got translated into English from the French genie. So that's where the confusion lied for me.
Mm-hmm. So, and the author talked about how she came upon these characters or these fantastical people, and she wanted to be pretty true to the history about them, except for she wanted to also make sure that the genie could not grant wishes. So as a character, the genie does not grant wishes.
Right.
So the book takes place in late 1800s, mostly in New York City. So what, you know, do you want to talk a little bit about that, Melissa, just what you thought about the setting and the time period?
I thought the author did a great job with New York City. Marianne and I were talking about this a little bit the other day, about the author's writing style. She's not the type of writer that we normally really enjoy the most. There's not a lot of lyricism in the writing, but she did a great job at the setting, of telling the story, and really good descriptive writer. So New York City, to me, just really came alive. I could see all the immigrants, all the activity, the horses, the carriages, the colors, the dirt, all that was very vivid, those descriptions.
I agree. And in some of the scenes when the Gollum and the genie are traveling through the city on the rooftops, I almost feel like I have a bird's eye view of the city and
yes.
what's going on. You can see them moving through there.
Indeed. Yeah.
So even the smells. You were talking about the sights, but you can even get a sense of the smells of the place.
Oh, right. One of the characters at one point is working in the bakery. You smell that. And the different neighborhoods. You know, there's Jewish quarters, there's the Syrian quarters, and so all that variety,
right.
The different flavors really come through.
This is just something that came to mind. Definitely the visual
mm-hmm.
and the smells, but no taste. And I wonder if that's perhaps because the Gollum cannot taste anything.
Right.
They don't eat.
Mm-hmm. And that was interesting, though, that both the main characters, the Gollum and the Ginny, do you remember, experimented,
right.
Forced themselves to eat because they were having to protect their identity, their real identity, from mm-hmm. their neighbors and all.
Right,
and
So I guess they could taste as a sensation, but it didn't mean anything special to them.
Right, right. They didn't need it, so
right.
it wasn't.
Right.
So I don't want to be a Gollum or a Ginny.
No,
I can't eat. No, thank you. The other thing, though, is they don't sleep.
No.
So in some ways, I thought, well, that's fascinating. Look at how much you can get done.
or how bored you'd be.
Well, and they were bored.
Yes. Yeah. They were so bored. Yeah. That, I thought that was interesting, though, because that was one of the things they had in common. And I liked that was brought out. They both struggled with how do we
spend
deal
our
with
time.
These long hours. Yeah,
I think that's another reason it had to take place in 1899. Because if it was modern day, they'd have cable TV and they would just really perform nothing useful.
Right.
So I think as we talk about this book, we're going to be really examining the character of these two people and comparing and contrasting them. Because in some ways they're so similar, in some ways they're obviously very different. So one of the things that I had made a note about, well, first of all, when I started the book, three things that I was just wondering about. So how did Shalman, and we'll talk about him later, he's a wizard, how did he become what he was? Who captured the genie? And then does the golem have a soul? So, we're, you know, we're going to be talking about a lot of things, but I think we'll touch on those. So one of the things we made a note about was who is more vulnerable? So we've been talking about Gollum and the genie, and I think we might want to start calling them by their name. So the Gollum has the name Chava.
Hava.
Thank you. And Ahmad is the genie.
Ahmed.
Oh, dear.
Thank you. I should have allowed her to do that. So Marianne did some research, actually, on the names and what they meant, too. So I don't know if you want to say anything.
Well, Hava is mentioned in the book as meaning life, and that was the golem and the rabbi that she comes across who protects her and becomes her guardian in New York when she is wandering masterlessly, gives her the name Hava, meaning life. And that kind of sparked me to investigate the other names that are used in the book, and then I found out that most of the characters, only a couple of them, just kind of had peripheral names, but the most of the characters of any importance, their names were appropriate for their characters. So I can find Ahmed, who is the genie. He is, the translation is the praised one. And then the other possible names that they were thinking of for him, I thought was interesting too. Bashir, meaning bearer of good news. Ibrahim is the father, father of multitude. And it turns out that Ibrahim is the same as Avram, who is the rabbi that protected the golem. So it kind of goes around there. Harun was another one that means the exalted one, and also a character from 1001 Arabian Nights. And Hussein was also one that they considered that meant good, handsome one. So there's a little a taste of all the names that I'm sure the author, it's more than coincidence, I think, that all these names really meant something and were appropriate to the various characters.
I think the author really did a lot of research in so many aspects of the book.
She took 7 years. Yeah, took her 7 years to write the book. So the golem is a new live creature. She has just recently come to life, so to speak, and the genie has been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So, you know, looking at this idea about vulnerability, you would think, well, the golem's more vulnerable because she's so new and she's trying to acclimate to this New York City and how to live and fit in and not draw attention to herself. But the genie is also very vulnerable.
Physically, he was vulnerable because he's made of fire. So if he gets, if he's out in the rain too long, he can end up being killed, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So, and interesting that New York, so much water around the city, so he's has to be careful of that.
And at one point, who is it that insists he gets an umbrella?
Hava.
Oh. Okay, yeah.
Once they've
protect
met,
him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And a hat also. I think the tinsmith wanted him to make sure he had a hat.
Yes, and he hates both of those things.
This doesn't sound very masculine.
No.
But the genie's other vulnerability is that because he was captured by the wizard, he has this iron cuff on him. So his powers are somewhat limited because of that.
Mm-hmm. And that's another major theme in the book is freedom, because that iron band keeps him trapped.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought there were lots of characters, I mean, lots of ways that the author is exploring the theme of freedom.
Well, he has no memory of how he got trapped. So that's, you know, a great portion of the book, too, mm-hmm. that he's trying to recall what happened. Why does he have that iron band on him? And, you know, we get some of the backstory as the book unfolds. But so that, I think, makes him even more vulnerable because he doesn't know what happened and how, you know, could it happen again. So he's kind of on guard.
Right. He doesn't remember how that happened. And it's almost like there's this chunk of his identity that's missing. don't you think? Because his memories are missing. And that was a recurring theme I saw as well, of just identity, what gives you your identity. Sometimes it's the names. That was another, but definitely vulnerable because he's trapped.
Mm-hmm. And Hava is vulnerable because she has this incredible strength, and at some point she learns that she could kill easily, and she is almost afraid of herself, wouldn't you say, that she's concerned that what happens if this part of her
snaps.
Yeah. And she can't control it.
And because she has no master to control her actions, and so she doesn't know what's going to trigger it. She does seem to have a free will, and she realizes. So if she gets angry enough, something bad could happen. But I think because she knows that she is so young and new, I mean, she's only a few days old in the story, really. Uh-huh. But she comes with a lot of knowledge just magically because she's created magically. But I think her awareness of her real age of a couple of days makes her careful and considerate. And she's not so the Ginny is more spontaneous, and she needs to be less so.
And that was my observation, because I made the comment about, are there sexist elements to these roles? And of course, it's 1899, and so of course the Ginny's going to have more freedom with regards to being able to go out at night and be visible and, you know, take more chances. And again, because he's older and has had some experience, but the Golem has to be very careful. And because she's so new that she doesn't know what could happen. But I mean, again, that's in some ways, is it a sexist role? Because then she has to stay inside and she takes up sewing. And
this is a time where women and men dressed very differently. So it's obvious if a woman is walking around at night. She can't be mistaken for a man unless she dresses like a man. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're in big skirts and big hats and things. So a woman walking at night obviously will be mistaken,
right,
for a woman of ill repute.
But once she gets to go out and run around with the Ginny, she experiences great freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That was so cute. So along the lines of what we're talking about, that vulnerability, I think we also had looked at the independence versus dependency of these two characters. And so we've been talking a little bit about their age and what part that plays in on it. But, this idea that initially that the Ginny could go out and explore more, and he really gets to know the whole city, and he takes a lover. So why did you think that was an important part of this story?
I think it's part of his spontaneous nature. And he lives so long, that's kind of, there's a, you know, a commitment aspect of it. He's lived for centuries, for millennia, perhaps, possibly. And you can't possibly have just one mate during all that time, especially if you live that long and your mate probably doesn't. So I don't think he's tied to any sort of commitment. So he's a bit more freer in his associations with people and other creatures.
One of the interesting things that I thought was interesting was that you see his character, and a lot of the characters, you see them initially, how we first meet them, how they are, his past, his nature, that is just part of his nature, of feeling free to find his pleasure and not be concerned with consequences. But over time, throughout the book, that changes a little bit.
Well, because they end up having a conversation about that, the Golem and the Ginny, and she accuses him of just taking his pleasure and doing what he wants, mm-hmm. and doesn't think about the consequences, that he's only thinking about his own needs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, you have to almost remind yourself that these are not humans, so to speak. They're creatures, and they're having this very deep moral kind of conversation about, you know, what's right or wrong here.
Right.
So.
And the genie also takes more risks than the golem ever does. The golem, like we mentioned before, is very careful. And there is that scene where he jumps over the puddle mm-hmm. at an intersection. Mm-hmm. And if he falls in, he can get hurt or even die because he's made of fire. And and also to be seen by mortals,
right.
That would give away that they are magical. So the golem is concerned. You know, what if somebody sees him? And he says the risk was worth it. And she says, what, to gain a few moments to get there quicker? And his reply was, no, it's a reminder that I'm still alive. And so he's had all of these years to live, and he still strives to feel alive. And I think the golem hasn't gotten there yet. She doesn't quite know what that experience is.
Yeah, and he's more aware of how trapped he is, I think, because of his experience. And mm-hmm. she is still so new, and she certainly has those feelings, I think, of being trapped, of being limited. But, yeah, he's more aware of it.
Well, and he was in that copper flask for a very long time.
Long time.
A couple hundred years or something. So he is probably enjoying his freedom mm-hmm. again. Yeah.
And the freedoms for the listeners, the freedoms that he used to enjoy, he used to be able to fly around the desert and
change forms
and associate with other creatures, magical creatures in the desert, as well as humans, and build castles and
enter people's
mm-hmm. dreams, which was like a drug addiction to him. he was careful not to do it too much because it could become an addiction. But, yeah, those are the freedoms that he lost once he got the iron cuff on him, and he's now stuck in human form and can no longer fly across hundreds and hundreds of miles at whim. And
yeah, when the author reflects back on it, you know, his history and how he would spy on, or however you want to put it, humans, the Bedouins, mm-hmm. or whoever was crossing the desert, and how fascinated he would be by that, and his entertainments in watching people.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, a very great sense of a freedom to do whatever he wanted to do. And so to be captured. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that. How does the genie get captured and what that does to him?
Well, it's sort of complicated.
It is complicated.
It starts with entering that girl's dreams, a young Bedouin girl.
Fadwa.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he, I guess he has the ability to plant seed in her. And so the father tries to exorcise the genie, what was left out of the daughter, and takes the daughter to a wizard whose name happens to be a master of the iron.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the name of the wizard, hence the iron cuff. And in that struggle during the exorcism, the wizard now realizes that he can capture.
Which he's always
creature.
Wanted to do. He mm-hmm. knew that would be the ultimate test. And it would give him more power if he had a genie captured.
And the girl, the poor unfortunate girl, her name was Fadwa, meant self-sacrifice.
Huh. Mm-hmm. So again, mm-hmm. yeah. Name has meaning. So yeah, so she has to die as part of that capturing of the genie. But so did you want to say the other complicated part? Because that wizard becomes...
Right. Later, we discover that wizard is the reincarnation of...
Shalman.
And Shalman is the person who creates the golem. Am I right on
Yes. So, you know, so now the story comes full circle. They've got more connection than just that they end up in New York City together, and they've got all these other kinds of commonalities.
And all the reincarnations that he goes through over the centuries, they mention he's all over the map, all over the world, all different kinds of cultures. And in each of these reincarnations, he starts out as a normal, regular person, but then there's something in him that makes him strive to be more. And then finally, as this shaman character, he does attain that more by creating the golem.
So over the centuries, as he's reincarnating and ends up as shaman, there was always kind of an evil. I think they succumbed to the evil rather than, like,
the
power for good.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And
A greedy power.
Yes. Mm-hmm. For their own self-interests. And so, so then when Shulman, who's the wizard, creates the golem, do you think he does that for selfish reasons?
I think so, to prove that he can do it.
Yeah. Yes.
Can I bring up the name again? Shulman? apparently the word shawl in German means a braggart.
Oh. So. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So that I think sense. He does kind of have this hubris in him that he wants to finally prove. Because we go through Shulman's life, too, and it's a pretty miserable life. But he wants to do something spectacular and be stronger than the other rabbis that taught him.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there was anything really redemptive about his character. Because there was about every other character. I mean, I saw lots of conflict, struggles sort of between good and bad. No character was completely just a one-dimensional character.
Well, Shulman started out as being very, very pious. He was.
That's right.
Yeah, he was he's even a brilliant.
Brilliant young student.
Student in the yeshiva, and he. Everybody thought he was going to be the ultimate rabbi, but then he took his faith so seriously that any infraction that that any humans would do in the course of day to day was just a mortal sin to him, and that degenerated his mind.
He had that strange dream where he saw something and felt like he was damned. So no matter what else he was.
No matter how good he was.
Exactly. And so, like you were saying, just by being human, he was damned. And he went downhill from there.
So in carrying all those past lives with him, I almost think that, and we can talk about that because the book brings it up as far as what is his nature. So could he have had any other life, or would he have had to have turned out evil? But before you answer that, we just want to remind people that you're listening to KVRF, Radio Free Palmer, and if you want to call in and talk to us about the conversation we're having, or if you've read the book and you have some comments, the number is 745-8900. So we're talking about the wizard and his evil nature.
What was the question?
Wow. Attention span. Well, the idea that could he have been any other way, or was that predetermined? So maybe he didn't have free will.
No, I think his character was in line with all the other reincarnations of this particular soul, I guess. And he was just the culmination of everybody's attempts of being something greater, and it finally happened. Is that where you're going?
But why? I mean, okay, so if he's the culmination, he carries with him sort of like this.
The baggage of all.
Yeah, the accumulation of the knowledge, and now he's going to seek immortality is what he wants. And so in doing that, and we talked about what his name means, and so is he predetermined to be evil, or do you think he had free will?
I think he had free will, and he chose power. And with that power happened to come evilness.
Yeah, I think I agree with Marianne there. Out of all the characters, he made the choice to be the least good. Well, the others struggled.
When he had the opportunity to be good, because part of his, when he arrives in New York and he's an immigrant, he's not speaking English, and so he ends up at
the
shelter for Jewish immigrants. Mm-hmm. And so he quickly makes himself useful so he can stay there longer. And in doing that, he actually does do good.
Yeah, but it was self-serving.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. But don't most people...
Did he really care about doing the good, or was he more concerned about having a place
to
stay?
True, but if the results are the same, does it matter?
Yes.
Why?
I don't know.
I think because he was doing it for selfish reasons, the reasons were wrong. I think the results for the immigrants that benefited were good.
So you can talk about doing the right thing for the wrong reason.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And who it is that is the recipient of the goodness or the badness. So he certainly did help a lot of people, but I don't think he cared whether he helped or not. Mm-hmm. I think his bottom line was for himself.
And he did more evil than he did good.
So on the scales of justice, mm-hmm. we already agree he's a bad, bad man.
I was just looking at my notes, and this character, his name is Joseph Shulman. And it's interesting because his name means increase piety, which he started out very pious. And then it goes on to, again, increasing power and influence. So that's what Joseph means, and that's...
Oh, okay.
I'm saying all of those characters.
I'm so glad you did that. It really is revealing, and I think the author obviously chose those carefully. Mm-hmm. So we brought up now that Shulman worked at the Jewish shelter, and one of the things that this book is full of is all kinds of characters. And so as we're being introduced to New York City in 1899, and you mentioned all the different neighborhoods, but just the social kind of classes and the different status of people. I mean, that was fascinating, too. And I think it's the golem, isn't it, who can speak any language.
Right.
Right. Yes. But could the genie?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, the genie only spoke Arabic.
I think that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He didn't understand Yiddish. And he didn't understand the Scandinavian languages on the docks.
But she could.
But she could. She,
and so that was another strength that she certainly had. Mm-hmm. He was more vulnerable in some ways if he didn't communicate or didn't understand the language. So that was a strength of hers.
Which is interesting because the original definition of the golem is that they don't speak. Mm-hmm. But she was given the power of all the languages. But that, what made her vulnerable is she could speak them all without an accent, which would give her away.
And certainly, you know, talking about social status, if for anybody who would come across her and, you know, so not assuming that she could speak the language, but that when she does respond, you know, that they would wonder, why are you able to speak mm-hmm. in this language also? So, but, okay, so the Ginny lives in the New Syria. I think it's called that neighborhood.
Little Syria.
Little Syria. So so there's wonderful characters in that neighborhood. Miriam, did I say that one right?
Miriam. Means love or rebellious.
Oh.
Yeah.
And again, that's true to the character, uh-huh, right? Uh-huh. So she has a coffee shop with her mm-hmm. husband, and she's the kind of caretaker almost for that whole neighborhood.
Right.
So she's involved in everybody's lives, but she does it in a way that's very kind and generous and loving. Mm-hmm. So what part of her do you think is rebellious?
Well, I think she went beyond a role of the humble housewife. She went outside of her physical boundaries of the coffee shop and kind of bucked the norms, the status of that culture.
She had support in doing that, though. I mean, her husband was supportive mm-hmm. of her sort of reaching out, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, and everybody loved Achmet, the genie, except mm-hmm. her.
Right.
So she's a little bit rebellious in that terms right. of that, because her community all thinks this is a wonderful person, and she's just getting rubbed the wrong way by him.
Right. She didn't trust him.
She wasn't buying it.
Yeah, something was going on mm-hmm. with that guy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So she helps other characters in the book. So one of the other interesting in the back of the book, when the author talks about who might be one of her favorite characters, is it Soleil?
I don't know how to pronounce that.
I said
Soleil.
Soleil, okay.
I don't know.
The ice cream guy. And she had just come across a news story the author had about this man on the street from an old edition of a New York newspaper of sitting in front of an ice cream churn. And mm-hmm. she wrote that into the story. And so Soleil also has some history.
Mm-hmm. He had been a doctor, and he became sort of taken over by a type of a djinn.
An ifrit.
An ifrit, mm-hmm. yeah. A less mm-hmm. powerful djinn.
And a more djinn-y. Evil, I think, a yeah. more malicious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he couldn't look at anybody in the face. He would just see empty holes where their eyes would be. And so the ice cream maker just kind of was going through his life of keeping his eyes down. And was poor, and...
Yeah, he started out well off as a doctor in mm-hmm. his own country, mm-hmm. and then his wife had died, and then his daughter had died, so he went through a lot of trauma. And then when he helped a particular poor girl that was possessed, and then he was attacked by the ifrit.
He was a man
eyes.
Of science, and
right,
so he didn't was. Believe in that.
Right.
He believed
right.
that, you know, there was some, you know, medical reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, there is trauma-induced epilepsy, and he became epileptic, and so the trauma of losing his wife and his daughter, they call it trauma-induced non-epileptic seizures, I think is the term. And that's what he ended up suffering from, which made him a bit magical. Because often shamans and medicine people do have some sort of disability that makes them different.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this the seizure disorder.
And he ended up playing an interesting role at the end of the book. But I just realized, as Marianne was talking, that that was another incident, another time when Shulman ended up doing something good, but for selfish reasons, because he was ended up wanting some information that Soleil had and delved into his mind to retrieve that information, and in doing that, got rid of the evil spirit.
Possession.
Mm-hmm. Possession, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the ice cream maker was free.
He got his mind back.
But that was the second good thing he did for him. Because remember when Soleil followed the genie to his lover's mansion.
Mm-hmm.
And he finds him there because he's exhausted because he's been running, trying to keep up with him to get there. And he carries him all the way back.
Shulman does?
No.
The Jenny does that.
For Sol. You're both looking at me like, I don't remember that.
No, I remember that, but I think we're talking about two different
Exactly. So,
things.
I mean, he does two good things.
No,
oh, I'm
talking
about Shulman did something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But lots of interesting characters and lots of complications. I mean, things being woven together here.
And I'm thinking, if there's anyone listening who hasn't read the book, they're thinking, oh, my God, I have no idea where this book is going.
Exactly. But there's too much. There's
yes.
just way too much to
yes.
try to explain it all now.
So we're talking about wonderful characters, but we're talking about some of the themes in the book, too. And so I don't even know where I wanted to go with that.
Well, I wanted to mention something that as you read anything, you come with preconceived notions of meanings of words or cultures or histories. And one thing that had confused me in the beginning and probably still does for me is Gollum is such a masculine-sounding word, yet the character in the book is a female. And the Ginny, I think probably because it sounds like Jean or Jenny or something, is such a feminine sounding word, yet the character is a male.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this author has done a lot of, has put in effort to break stereotypes of maybe notions that we would bring in. And another one that that I thought was fascinating, because I had no idea, Little Syria, I assumed, was a Muslim neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. There's actually only one Muslim character in this entire book, and that's the Ginny. And the folks that live in Little Syria are actually Catholics.
That was very interesting. Yeah,
they're, mm-hmm. they're Maronite Catholics that come from the Arab region.
Lebanon, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of her research that she found that.
Yeah.
So, and we've talked about, you know, comparing their vulnerability and independence and dependence. But one of the other comments we had written down were the issues about faith and religion. So you're bringing up that, you know, it was a Catholic neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so you get kind of mixed feelings, or I did anyway, about what is this author saying about religion? Because one of the first references, and there's many references to religious things, but one of the one that I remember is the Golem is bored. She's living with the rabbi who has rescued her, and she's bored, so he gives her a Bible to read. And she, you know, it was a really funny scene. And she is just trying to make sense of this, and so the next day she's asking questions about these Bible stories, and they are just, they just seem pointless to her. So he's trying to explain the lessons to it, and she just wants to give up. She just does not want to spend her evenings reading the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then part of the question in the book is, because she was created from clay, is this a, does she have a soul? I think we talked a little bit about her morality, but do you think she has a soul?
Well, the easy answer is no, because, and that was, I can't remember now if it was actually brought out in the book or if it was brought out in something, a blog or something that I read of the author's, but it was saying that only God can create a soul, and so this was so obviously created by man that no, she doesn't have a soul. But then you start looking at all the qualities she does have and how those intelligence and awareness, compassion, yep, mm-hmm. and how those grow throughout as we get to know her.
But I think also it depends on what your religious background is.
Right.
Because some religions, inanimate objects do have souls, in which case there would be no problem
assigning
us a soul
to
the Golem.
Because she's Hebrew, she's created by the Hebrew wizard, do you think mm-hmm. that would... But a golem would not typically have a soul. They're there simply as a means for a master to
right.
to direct them.
But the author twists religion a bit with this reincarnation
mm-hmm.
The theme going as well. You know where
because
well
the,
that's an Eastern philosophy.
And the soul shows up all over the place.
Right, this right. Instead of once and then either going to heaven or hell. So it's kind of hard to. I think it's hard to pinpoint, hard to nail down, really. I think she leaves it open for us to consider.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and just in your argument, Melissa, I mean, in some ways, I mean, we all make, in procreation, we make the next, you know, mm-hmm. person. So, you know, perhaps even when Shalman made the Golem, he, you know, whatever.
So would, I wonder, would he have to give up a little bit of his soul to do that?
Another good question. Yeah.
Even the sound man is going,
Now we're getting deep. So, but you made some other interesting notes about who, you know, when we look at people and who's truer, who the truest to their faith, because we've got the rabbi who rescues Hava.
Mm-hmm. Yet he lies to people.
How does he lie?
In order to protect Hava
mm-hmm.
and say, oh, you know, she's new to town or, you know, he makes up a history for her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you shouldn't lie, but he has to.
Mm-hmm.
So there he's bending his rules But he's like the high rabbi there. You know, he's well respected.
And he has her living with him.
Yeah.
Which doesn't look good either.
No.
No.
No. Not at all.
And he was embarrassed when he had to go out and buy her all those lady things. So, her clothing. But, so yeah, so he's struggling with that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, saying things in order to help her get a job and a place to live. And then the other person, okay, we've talked about Shalman and as far as, you know, that.
And I like the Michael character.
We haven't even talked about him. Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell us about Michael.
Michael is the rabbi's nephew. And he is an atheist. He was raised, of course, in the Jewish community, but he, through his studies, decided that, and I think the Times and his friends and the people he associated with were Marxists and atheists and all sorts of intellectual thinkers of that time. Yet he is the one who has a sheltering house for all these immigrants, and he helps thousands. I mean, if we count, I can't remember how many beds he's got, but doing this shelter for years, I mean, he's helped thousands and thousands of people. And so without a God, without a faith, or I suppose his faith is atheism, if mm-hmm. we want to consider
maybe,
it like that.
Maybe humanism.
Humanism.
Yes.
You know, he has reached out and helped more people, touched more lives than probably anybody else in the book.
He does good works,
mm-hmm.
yes. So mm-hmm. his labors show his mm-hmm. goodness.
And then he ends up marrying Hava.
There you go. There's another tie-in. So... were you surprised about that? I mean, Hava was created to be a particular character's wife who, you know, dies off very early in the book. But so she feels the need to have a protector. And so
she... And I think she does because she's too young.
Mm-hmm.
I think if she was older and had more life experience, and maybe like the Miriam character
mm-hmm.
who... kind of knew how to navigate the world.
Right.
She maybe would not have needed a husband, but I think she needed a protector to survive, but also to look good, I guess, and you know, in society.
Right. Although, I mean, I don't think it wasn't a husband necessarily that she needed. She
no.
needed a protector, and she just at that point with what was going on, she didn't see any other options.
And she really hadn't given it a lot of thought.
Right. It was spontaneous.
And so when she ends up married, and we've talked about how she doesn't eat and mm-hmm. she doesn't sleep, so how is she going to hide that from her now husband?
And she doesn't breathe.
She doesn't breathe. Right. That's when we learn she doesn't breathe. So she has to lay there in bed, not sleeping, and make her chest rise and fall so he thinks she's breathing.
What a boring life.
Poor thing. But I made a note about this comment, too, because I thought this was another funny thing. And this is later on when she's a married woman. She'd begun to wonder whether she still had a will of her own.
Right.
And I thought, and my comment was like any married woman in 1899.
Yep.
Yeah. But she did keep her job in the bakery,
mm-hmm.
even after she got married. And I think she still took in her sewing.
Right.
So she had, you know, things that kept her busy that way and those relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And she did mention, and this is the contradiction here. She mentioned before the marriage thing happened, to have a master again would be like dying, and she was afraid of losing her free will. Yet, that's what she has to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were so many conflicts. I mean, that was just one. I mean, she wanted her freedom, but she knew she, to some extent, couldn't have it.
And just those efforts. So that was, you know, in a relationship with Michael. And then the other thing we didn't talk about, that because she was created to please a master and she's masterless, she can hear and feel all the needs and wants of all the people she comes into contact with. And so it's all she can do not to to provide for all of these people and to somehow get them what it is that they want.
Right.
She needed that narrowed down to one.
Right. Do you remember when she was in the bakery? There was a comment. At some point, she realized that if she was able to supply a need, say someone came in with a specific need, maybe they didn't know exactly what they wanted, but she could tell, and she gave it to them. In that moment, she felt free.
And complete.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just thought that was interesting.
Yes.
Because that's something that even we can relate to at times.
That's a very human characteristic.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So at the... maybe we're getting a call, but we can talk about the bakery, too. Hello?
Hello. Radio Free Palmer?
Hi, Helen.
Yes. Who? And so when they finish their conversation, I'd like to make a comment.
Go ahead and make your comment now.
Okay. Oh, I'll shut my radio off. I like the book very, very much. When I went into the Fireside bookstore a month ago, one of the booksellers at the store said, "Oh, it's a wonderful book. You'll love it." And I did. I class it as one of the best books I have read in several years, mostly because there were so many characters and their themes and their problems and conflicts that were woven together, and I had no idea where this story was going. And I wondered if all of the problems and conflicts would be solved at the end of the book. Then my only question is, do men like this book? I guess there's one more question. I haven't heard you say what the book is next month.
Oh, and I will announce that. But, So you said that you were wondering if it would all be resolved. Do you feel it's resolved at the end?
Yes, I did. But that's what I was feeling when I was reading the book. Would all of the problems of the characters we met, would they all come to a resolution? It took a long time, and I didn't know how they would come about. But, no, I had a good feeling at the end of the book.
Okay. You were going to say something, Melissa?
I really liked how the book ended with Hava talking about hope. So I don't think everything was resolved, or we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but hope was a real theme throughout the book as well, I thought.
Because the Ginny still has the bracelet on, right?
Right, yeah. But he's...
And the evil is still...
Loose.
Loose.
But contained for the time being, anyway.
So is there anything else you want to say, Helen, or...
No.
Okay.
I'll just hang up.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Bye.
Bye.
That was an interesting question Helen had about, here we are three females talking about the book. I don't know if it's a female-oriented book or...
That is a good question. I do happen to know one man who read it and enjoyed it very much.
Well, we can speak for one. So we were talking about the bakery, because that is where Hava makes her friendships, or gains at least one friend. And so the scene where when her friend from the bakery, Anna, invites her to the dance, and so she's at the dance, and she turns out she's very good at dancing, and then she's so excited because she was supposed to meet the Ginny and decides she'll go find him and bring him to the dance. It's almost like that is just the happiest time for the both of them.
Yes. Yeah, and I liked how when the Ginny went into the dance hall, for a moment he was reminded of his palace-like home that he had created, and so there was joy there, but there was also sadness because he realized that was the best he was ever going to see again.
It was
the closest.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, and that was the moment when you really felt them drawing, Ginny and Hava, drawing close together, that maybe there would be romantic feelings between the two of them. So that was fun.
Maybe.
Maybe.
So do you think that's where we're left at the end of the book? Is that maybe?
Maybe.
I think so. I think definitely.
Well, they're the most suited for each other. They don't have to pretend they're sleeping or pretend they're eating.
They can hang out at night.
Yes, go out. And then, of course, we learn that Jenny is actually quite an artist with metalsmithing. So there's a whole portion of the story that talks about him making this wonderful roof or a ceiling in one of the buildings.
Mm-hmm. And I had that one question about the creatures that the genie would make. He would just take metal in his hands and gold and silver, mm-hmm. and make creatures, birds and such out of them. And one of the creatures was a bird in a cage, and that was a pretty obvious symbolism that, you know, he was a caged bird. But he would also make other creatures. But there was this one creature that he could never get right, and it was the ibis.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, he couldn't get the beak right. But then there was that comment by, and I can't remember who the character was.
Sayla.
Was it Sayla?
Yes.
That said, well, maybe you're making something new.
Yes.
And I thought, well, that's where it was going to. Because I was looking for symbolism in the bird itself, and uh-huh. I found nothing. There was the bird. I couldn't find any meaning attached to the type of bird, the ibis.
Uh-huh.
But then I think the point came in the end where he was, well, forget about what it's supposed to look like. Maybe you're creating something new. And
that tied into that hope,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And
with
change.
Right. With individuals and with relationships. And
yeah, and the expectations they had for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because
right.
they
right.
really did not right. turn out to be, like you started at the very beginning of this conversation, defining them.
Mm-hmm.
They were no longer those things.
Right. Yeah. Tying in with the identity again, that they, and but that perhaps it was going to be okay that they aren't who they started out to be, who they thought they were. And I think they can find something together.
Well, they're going to live a long time. So.
Yes, they can go through all kinds of phases. And the other thing that the author points out is that this is a timely story, and she comments on this in the back, that it's because people are still worried about multiculturalism, globalism, the tensions between science and religion, and between tradition and assimilation. So I think we did a good job. I think we talked about all of those things. Give ourselves kudos on that, huh? So I want to thank my guests, Melissa and Marianne, and Helen for calling in.
Well, thank you.
For joining me. I'd like to remind listeners again that if you are in a book club and would like to suggest a book and be on the air with me, please call the station or send an email. The next radio book club will be March 26th at noon. We'll be discussing Pandora's Lunchbox, How Processed Food Took Over the American Meal by Melanie Warner. And just a quote from online, it said, from breakfast cereal to chicken subs to nutrition bars, processed foods account for roughly 70% of our nation's calories. So copies are available at Fireside Bookstore. And joining me will be Winona Benson, the nutrition educator from the Cooperative Extension Service, and Lisa Boyles, who's a nutritionist in training. So until next time, thank you.